Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, we'll survey the jazz landscape with diva great Klee Thompson. Blues, swing, Latin, Afro-Cuban, she's got you covered, and it's all for a very worthy cause. Then go grab your goggles and get ready for some major heat. Glassblower John Nygren is here with the zen of what he does best. There's poetry reading and the method behind her word choices with Terry Kirby Erickson, a look beyond the score with North Carolina composer Kenneth Frizzell, and understanding classical music with Karoff at the keyboard. Tenor and conductor Jamie Albritton is here with the Met HD preview, and world-class Irish accordion player Benny McCarthy shares the magic of Danu next on Triad Arts Weekend. Are you tired of the usual Black Friday of shopping and consumerism? Well, this year, the Community Arts Cafe and Habitat are providing a feel-good alternative. Tonight, November 23rd, they'll present a benefit concert for Habitat for Humanity of Forsyth County. The first house concert for Habitat, the Black Friday Antidote, will be held at the cafe at 411 West 4th Street, featuring an evening of jazz artistry with the Klee Thompson Trio and the Piedmont Jazz Composers Collective. Doors open at 7 o'clock and music begins at 7:30. The suggested donation for admission is $15. You can also purchase food and drinks from the cafe and bar. The concert is the first of a series of house concerts benefiting Habitat for Sight's neighborhood revitalization effort, a sustainable approach to transforming neighborhoods. Habitat, residents, community organizations, local government, volunteers, and the private sector are teaming up to create a shared vision for neighborhood revitalization, and you can be part of it. In the meantime, here's jazz singer extraordinaire Klee Thompson.
Where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life. To get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails.
The very thing that I love so much about jazz is I can do it all in jazz. I can do blues, I can do Latin stuff, I can swing, I can do an incredible ballad, and that's why I love it.
Yeah, it's always freaked me out when someone says they hate jazz. I just want to say, well, what are you talking about? What kind of jazz? Are you talking about Latin jazz? You're talking about, just what you're talking about, hard swing? You're talking about, free jazz?
You don't
jazz?
Like the blues? I mean, what is it you don't like? Yeah, exactly. And that's interesting because I think that as a vocalist, I'm really pretty user-friendly when it comes to jazz.
What do you mean when you say user-friendly?
My heart is in melody. You know, that's where I live. The story is exceedingly important to me. I think that's my theater background, my acting background. Whereas there are jazz vocalists today who are doing some really exciting things rhythmically. And also, I think there are jazz vocalists out there now who consider themselves more an instrument, a part of the group, than necessarily a separate vocalist. And I think I gotta say, while I love some of the stuff they do, that's not where I live. You know, I'm gonna stick with that melody and I'm gonna tell the story
of a great love for me.
I hear that in your performances too. Like, you're singing to me, not just to a big room of folks.
And
I mean, it's easy to say, hard to do. What are you thinking of to bring that up?
First of all, it takes a lot of time, a lot of practice, and a lot of experience. For me, it just took me a lot of work to know that that was what I wanted to do. The other thing that really helped was when I was living in L.A., I went around to all the jazz clubs and I heard all the legends. And I just watched them and I learned from them. I remember going to places where there were 15 people in the club. And these guys were performing like there were 15,000 people there. And I said, that's what I want to do. That's the way I want to be. You know, just giving your all the time, being there, not phoning it in, not saying, oh, well, there's only 15 people here tonight, so, you know, I'll just give a little less. No, I don't do that.
Yeah.
You know? And the audience can tell the difference.
I remember, I think of Buddy Guy, if somebody heard in Chicago again. He just didn't care. He'd be at Biddy Mulligan's, you know, down by Howard L.
Yeah,
there'd be
exactly
12 drunk frat guys there, but he'd be
playing
like crazy.
Exactly. And that's how I've modeled myself.
Doodle Ben, that's okay. Today, my heart started to sing again. Doodle Ben, that's okay. And so many times I would cry, oh, I love the way that you love me. Doodle Ben, Doodle Ben.
The LA scene, because I mean, you're frequently back and forth between Los Angeles and Winston.
You have so many incredible musicians out there, folks who have just played with everybody, played everywhere, and they're local. And so when I go back there, I have access to those guys, and that is just really exciting to play with A-class musicians. And that was always my goal, was to work my technique and my journey to develop it enough that I could go back and hang with those guys. And I can, and it's really exciting.
Nice. And when you're sitting in with guys and gals that are that committed to the music, what's it do to your game? What do you in terms of your evolution as a jazz singer?
See, the whole thing about doing jazz is when you're doing jazz, you're flying without a net. There's no safety net underneath you. And your music is only going to be as strong as the weakest link. And usually that's the vocalist. I mean, that's just a known fact. You know, musicians see a vocalist coming and they just want to run. We have bad reputation. We don't know when to come in. We don't know what key we sing it, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I've worked very hard on getting past those. And now what happens when I play, and I'll play with different guys, and I'll put together a different trio for different gigs, each song comes out differently. It's a new song every time you do it. And that's the whole thing about jazz. That's the exciting part of it, but it's also the flying without the net, you know. But it is incredibly thrilling. There have been many times when I've said, oh, that one should have been recorded. And it was a first take.
Three kings of Orient bearing gifts, we traverse afar. Field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star. Three kings of Orient are.
My arrangement works with them, and they're adding stuff that I never thought of before because they're adding their own colors and their own spices. And it's just magical.
Talk about the We Three Kings of that arrangement, because I just love when I hear a tune that I love and it's presented in a way that's so fresh, I get to, you know, enjoy it all over again.
Yeah. We Three Kings was really interesting because I had a strong sense of how I wanted that tune done. I wanted you to get a feel of being on the desert and kind of loping along on a camel. I mean, that sounds probably crazy, but I wanted it to have this drive to it. And I wanted it to have a bit of a Middle Eastern African feel to it. And so when we got in the studio, the percussion obviously was the most important part of it, to lay it down. And I was working with Ray Armando, who is just an incredibly well-known percussionist. I mean, he's played with everybody in Brazil and all over the world. And so I gave him the tune, and he started laying down a Latin kind of groove. And I just listened to it, and I knew that that wasn't what I wanted. And I said, no, I really want it more African. Instantly, you know, he changed the drumming pattern and started to lay down the tune.
My perfect love.
After the first of the year, I started hearing this absolute buzz about the Community Arts Cafe. And I said, I gotta check this out. And I just thought there's so much music going on there. This jazz has got to be there, because there is just no place right now to go and hear jazz in Winston. Nada. Nothing. And at least this is giving us the opportunity to have some jazz coming on back. And the more people support it, then the more they'll get to hear jazz around Winston. But if you don't come out and support live music, then it can't be sustained.
Feliz Navidad, Feliz Navidad, Feliz Navidad, Prospero Año e Felicidad.
Feliz Navidad. Jazz diva Clee Thompson. If you're looking for an alternative to hours of shopping and fighting traffic on the day after Thanksgiving, and you'd like to usher in the season of giving by enjoying great music and contributing to your community, Buckley and her friends at Habitat for Humanity have just the ticket for you. The first house concert for Habitat, a Black Friday antidote, will be held at the cafe at 411 West 4th Street tonight, November 23rd, beginning at 7 o'clock. It'll feature Klee's jazz artistry with the Klee Thompson Trio and the Piedmont Jazz Composers Collective. The music begins at 7:30. The suggested donation for admission is $15, and you'll find links to more information and future house concerts for Habitat at wfdd.org/triadarts. Quiero desearte, quiero desearte una feliz Navidad. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got lots more great music coming up later in the show. There's classical with Kerov, contemporary with Ken, opera with All Britain, and Irish with Danu. But first, time to roll up our sleeves and work with our hands. If you'd like to see a love of nature expressed in artistic excellence by a true American master, you need look no further than the glass studio of North Carolina blower John Nygren. John's glassworks range from landscape vessels, classic vase forms with delicately wrought natural elements, to whimsical frogs, and they've been shown in more than 350 exhibitions throughout the world. You'll find links to his work at wfdd.org/triadarts. And in the meantime, let's meet the artist. I mean, I'd be curious to know about your love of nature, where it began, and how you find that. Obviously, we can talk about specific pieces later on, but maybe just in general, how that found its way into your artwork and as an expression.
I was interested in the natural world probably the first time I opened my eyes and got into it. Yeah. I had an insect collection that started when I was 3 and have just always been in the natural world. When I was in the high school era, I was relatively feral. I lived in a teepee most of the summer, and I remember just getting shoes on me and getting me back into school was, it was kind of like taking a wild horse and putting a saddle on it. It was a struggle. And so I've always had an affinity for the natural world. And it shows up in the work.
It sure does. One of the images that struck me was the frog climbing up on a rock-like form and turning around the corner, there's a snake looking at him. And I have to be honest, I saw it and I just laughed out loud when I saw it. There was just this, you just capture a moment there that just... you'd kind of hope to see in the woods if you're taking a walk or something like that.
Those were fun to do. There's been a series of what I would call confrontations, you know, two creatures running into each other, as it were. And the ultimate one, that I did a series of those, of frog, frog-snake, and other stuff too. But
And frog on a light bulb and frog on a candle. And
the ultimate confrontation was, I don't know if I did more than one, but there was this poison dart frog from Central America, which is absolutely deadly. You touch it and put it in your eye or, you know, rub your mouth or something and you've had it, is confronting a rattlesnake. And it's this lovely situation where if anybody messes up, everybody's had it. And it's just such, seems to me like these moments do happen in life, and it pays to pay attention.
Looking at the vase work, and then this is the frog climbing up the candle, a Japanese cherry blossom tree vase. They're all in the glass medium, and yet they're so different. Could you talk me through, is there a different vibe, a different feeling you get working with these very different pieces?
When I have made art through the years, in the beginning I had no idea about spirituality and all that, but instinctively... it seems that it was done from the right side of the brain. And I'm now totally, I'm more aware of that, let's say. And now when I'm doing the paintings, if I sense the left brain coming in and analyzing, you've done some red, you need to put something else over here, that's when I go away. I want these things to be snatched from wherever they come from. And going back into the glass, it was interesting. Sometimes I would walk up to the studio and I would have literally a visual image of a piece that I wanted to make. And on the odd occasion, that actually would happen. But what was just as apt to happen would be that I would start the piece, but then something else would happen. Maybe a mistake, maybe, who knows. But it would take a turn in a different direction, and I would just let it flow there. So something else totally different might happen. So But sometimes I would make that first gather and have no idea what was going to happen. It's kind of like some of the poems that I've written. I almost feel like I don't have the right to sign them because it's almost like I just held my hand out and something lit in it. There are things in this work that I've done that I don't see that other people see. Everybody comes from a different place in their life history, and so obviously they see an image, hear a poem, hear music, and it brings up things that relate to their life history. And that's the beauty of it. It can spark feelings, emotions, memories in someone else that the artist that made the piece has nothing. All it is a trigger, and that's the beauty of it. And I've had this happen in glass where people would buy a piece of glass and then I'd run into them a year and a half later and they would say, oh, I see such and such in this piece. And I'm thinking, now I know that piece of glass. How do they see that? But that's the miracle of it. Yeah. And it's quite exciting to have that happen.
I imagine.
Oh, yeah. There is no right or wrong right off the bat. It just simply is. And if someone relates to it, they do, and if they don't, they don't. And that's okay, too. People ask me, how did you get into the frogs? And I like them, but one way to explain it is if I have a form that I've already made and I gather a gather of hot glass, walk up to this form and with a little shaping and control with heat and cold and whatever, touch this hot glass to the form that already exists and gently pull it away and do some manipulation, it, on its own nature, makes a lovely frog body. So it has to do with the medium as much as anything else. I mean, this is a life thing, not just artists, to be aware of what's happening around us and react to it and with it in a manner that's compatible. I can say in my glass working in particular that a lot of the new directions that happened were the result of what I would call happy accidents, things that I witnessed as I was working in the material. And then I would realize, oh, I can do such and such with that. So a lot of what I guess I would call new ways of manipulating or working with the material comes simply from watching what's happening when one is working it. I can use that, just like life.
Senior member of the North Carolina glass art community and a renowned American master, Mr. John Nygren. You'll find links to images from John's studio at wfdd.org/triadarts. And this is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up after this short break, we get a peek into the worlds of poets and composers with two of our state's finest. Award-winning Winston-Salem poet Terry Kirby Erickson reads for us, and we'll sample new music by Winston-Salem composer Ken Frizzell before the crowds at Carnegie Hall get a taste. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Irish music by world-renowned Danu is coming to the Triad next week, but you'll hear him first coming up on the second half of the show. I'll chat with band manager and Irish accordion player extraordinaire Mr. Benny McCarthy. But first, it's time to pay tribute to the written word. More than a poet, Terry Kirby Erickson is the best friend you always wanted, the kind you can count on both to tell you the truth and to help you bear it. So wrote syndicated columnist and author of Birdbaths and Paper Cranes, Sharon Randall. Terry's most recent book of poetry is In the Palms of Angels, published by Press 53, and it's received both the Next Generation Book Awards Gold Medal and the Nautilus Book Awards Silver Medal. Terry calls Winston-Salem home.
Well, I was driving down the street in Surrey County, close to Mount Airy, and I just happened to look up and see the name Starlight Motel. At the time, it truly captured my imagination. And lo, these many years later, when I was sitting down to write a poem one day, it occurred to me, Starlight Motel. And I just started writing, and not all of my poems come as easily as this one, but this one just seemed to flow, and I wrote it without making very many changes to it at all. It's called Starlight Motel. He knew it was just an ordinary motel on the side of a busy highway. Nothing special about it, really. There were a billion more like it, lying along curbs like bums on a park bench. But when dusk settled on the roof like a soft blue cloth, rubbing away the harsh edges and inelegant angles, and the neon sign flashed the words, Starlight Motel, it never failed to move him. There was something magical in the name, as if the tired old building still pulsed with possibility, as if it were more than a place for afternoon trysts or weary travelers worn out from hours on the road. As he sat behind the desk night after night, reading the newspaper or watching the miniature television set hanging from the ceiling, he dispensed keys to characters of every age and description, while keeping an eye out for certain people. He recognized them right off, as soon as they came through the door, the ones who stopped because the sign drew them in. They had an air of expectation and a lighter step, as if the world weighed less heavily on their shoulders, like something wonderful waited just around the bend. Sometimes they were alone, but not always. It didn't matter. To them, he gave the best rooms, the ones near the office and the ice machine, where the name Starlight Motel shone through the windows like a benediction.
From Telling Tales of Dusk, Starlight Motel, and just the sound of the word Starlight Motel, you never know how or why things hit you, but it just does. It's pleasing to hear and say.
It is. That's what I thought when I read that, and it just occurred to me that it would be a wonderful place, and that name itself would draw a person in, and I wanted to write a poem about why that was. I'm not so much into creating poetry that uses all of my vocabulary in one poem. I was an English major in college. I know a lot of big words. It's not necessary that I use them in everything I write. I just find that it pleases me to write poetry that is accessible and readable. I don't want to write a poem that's particularly intimidating. It's okay if it's mysterious. It's okay if the meaning is a little bit questionable, but not completely questionable, so that people don't have any idea what I was talking about.
And I appreciate that so much, reading your work, because I just get this the immediacy of, I mean, as a selfish poetry reader, just this visceral experience. And the use of language, again, I hear, you know, sitting there like bombs on a park bench, you know, just the little alliteration at the beginning and the end and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You said that just kind of roll off.
It did. It absolutely did. And that happens sometimes. And it's always a gift when that happens. Other times you have to just hammer away at them, and they're like sculptures. You just have to keep chipping off pieces until you get to the essence of the poem, saying what you want to say as succinctly as possible, and be sure that you're communicating. I just want to be able to capture a person's interest and keep them throughout the poem from beginning to end.
You certainly achieved it in the poems that I've read. I want to know what's behind these characters. And the language, you hit the ground running with your work, and I really enjoy that. A Day in the Life is one that seems to speak to this use of language in a usable way. And would you mind reading
Sure.
A Day in the Life?
And this is a poem. I like to write humorous poems, too. And this poem came from a moment that is true. And, I mean, true in the sense of reality. You know, I really was wearing this ensemble. and thought it was hysterical, really, and decided to write a poem about it. So it's called A Day in the Life. Shuffling around the house in a pair of tattered blue slippers, wearing a bathrobe, prescription sunglasses, and Velcro rollers in my gray streaked hair, I feel like some demented old tart gearing up for an afternoon of soaps. All I need is a TV tray, four or five screeching cats, and a stack of hairdo magazines to complete this stage set of life on the flip side of 40, a tragicomedy of unfolding in my living room. I used to use fewer props, as I recall, jumping out of bed sleek as an otter, sliding down the day squealing. But times have changed. Now I need at least 2 hours to trowel on makeup, spray gunk in my hair, find clothes that won't pinch, pick, or otherwise annoy me, pack my purse, plaster a smile on my gravity challenge face, and greet the morning before it knocks on my door like one of those perky cosmetic hawking neighbors handing out pink sample sacks of futility.
This is great. Troweling on makeup, just that whole image. And one of the favorites was sleek as an otter. I just, I love the way that sounds again, mm-hmm. and it just comes out. How much time do you spend re-editing and looking at the sounds of words and that sort of thing in a poem like that, for example, A Day in the Life?
Well, that one did take a little bit of editing. There were some images that I got right away, and then there were others that I wanted to work a little while longer on because they just seemed a little bit incongruent. I was trying to create this impression of the layering of getting older because I started with an image of myself, obviously, in this bizarre outfit as I was trolling around my house and caught sight of myself in a mirror going, you know, oh, God, you poor thing. And then as I was writing the poem, I was like taking off all these layers that I had accumulated over these years of maturing and growing into a grown-up, supposedly. And I remember when I was a little girl, especially during the summer, you know, when you are children, you sleep deeply, you do everything so automatically and easily. You know, I would wake up completely refreshed. There were shorts on the floor or something and a t-shirt, and you just jump out of bed and jump in that and hurry up and go eat whatever your mother makes you eat for breakfast, and then you're out the door. And so I wanted to contrast that part of my life with this part of my life, which is very different.
Award-winning North Carolina poet Terry Kirby Erickson. Her most recent book of poems is In the Palms of Angels, and it's published by Press 53. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. And from poetry to contemporary music next, and life through the eyes and ears of one of today's leading composers. That's The Motion of Stone by North Carolina composer Kenneth Frazell. He's received commissions from some of the most consequential classical performers of our time, including cellist Yo-Yo Ma, soprano Dawn Upshaw, and flutist Paula Robeson. The Motion of Stone, based on a lengthy poem by A.R. Ammons called Tombstones, is a 40-minute, multi-movement work for full orchestra and chorus. For Frazell, the idea of setting Ammons' poetry to music came to him over 40 years ago, while still a student at the Juilliard School in New York. It was there, sitting and reading on the floor of the original Barnes & Noble, that he first came across the poet's work.
And it just jumped off the page the first time I read him, the way it flows. His mind is just racing through all kinds of beautiful ideas, and it's kind of a nonstop poetry. It's not usually metric in the traditional sense, and it really fit how my ear was putting notes to music. So I believe I've done 40 or 50 songs by now.
The Motion of Stone was Frazell's first leap into large-scale choral writing. According to tenor and University of North Carolina School of the Arts conductor Jamie Albritton, the composer was a quick study.
Meryl and I went to Boston to hear the premiere, and when I heard it, Ken said to me right away, "Will you do this?" And I said, "Are you kidding?" "Yes."
There's a very short trio of lines in the first movement, which is actually Ammon's first stanza, and I believe it's a tenor solo that says, "It breaks the heart that stone holds what time let go." And I love that because this poem deals with the human urge to try to memorialize people and hold on forever. We find the hardest substances we can, diamonds, rocks, whatever, to hold on to important things. And yet, the elements, water, wind, rain, the universe eventually, you know, is going to collide and explode. And even the most heartfelt things are impermanent.
For Jamie Albritton, it was never a matter of if. For Ken Frizzell's The Motion of Stone, it was only a question of when.
This piece has been back there in the file box turning ever since 1998. It demands a tremendous amount from the chorus. And I said, I just have to wait until I get the right chorus. I mean, they're students. You never know who's going to come to your school. They come, they learn, they leave. Every year it's a different ensemble. And I saw it coming this year, and I was right. Once I gave my first downbeat in the fall, I was like, no, we're going to be able to do it this year.
This is just a personal thank you to Jamie for resurrecting this piece. This is actually the first time the School of the Arts Orchestra has ever done a piece of mine. And I'm very honored that the place that I went to school that gave me so much and the place that has given me so much as a teacher for 20-odd years has taken this on. It means a lot to me.
Composer and UNCSA professor Kenneth Frizzell and tenor Piedmont Opera and UNCSA conductor Jamie Albritton. The Columbus and North Carolina Symphonies will be performing Ken's work later this season and next, and coming up this spring at Seacrest Performance Series, Strata will premiere a new work of Ken's titled A Book of Days for Violin, Clarinet, and Piano, based on passages from the Wake Forest University alumnus A.R. Ammons. You'll find links to Ken's complete performance schedule on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break right now. When we come back, we'll take a look at what makes the classical period classical, with Karoff at the keyboard. Then Jamie's back with a high-def look at the Metropolitan Opera's HD series, courtesy of Piedmont Opera. And we'll wrap things up today with an Irish holiday celebration with Danu, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to put on our powdered white wigs as we join Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff at the keyboard.
You know, there's a period in music history we call the classical era. It runs from about 1750 to about 1800 or so. That's a funny term, isn't it? Classical era. I thought all of the music we've been talking about is classical music. So why is this 50-year period considered more classical than the period before or the period after? The period contains, for example, the music of Mozart, the music of Haydn, and some early works by Beethoven as well. It's a funny thing. If you think about what's a classic or what is classical, anything that withstands the test of time, I suppose. But of course, it refers back most of all to classical period in history, ancient Greeks and ancient Romans, a sense that there was a kind of peak of cultural perfection that happened way back when. And there's something about this music, particularly the composers based in Vienna in the second half of the 18th century, that seems more poised, more balanced, more formally perfect than the music that came before, the music that came after. And so we use this term classical advisedly. All right, well, what about the music that's so classical? One thing we notice right away is that the melodies in this time frame tend to be very balanced. They come at us in a kind of question and answer format. Question. Answer. question. Answer. You get the idea. So there's this kind of balanced, almost rhyming approach to melodies where we say it has an antecedent and consequent phrase. That is to say, simply, it has a kind of question posed and then immediately answers itself. One of the characteristics of the music of Mozart and Haydn is that they moved away from the rich counterpoint and the rich multiple melodies of Bach and Handel to a simpler musical texture. Or the example I played earlier. If Bach had written that melody, you'd have three or four other melodies going on at the same time. Something like that. Whereas Mozart just has the melody, very simple, very poised, and underneath it, not a second melody, not a lot of counterpoint, but simply. So we know that the melodies are this kind of question and answer approach. We know that the texture tends to be a little simpler. What keeps our interest then? Well, this period has a lot of very interesting and very complex musical forms. It's the beginning of the symphony, for example. It's the beginning of the classical style sonata that then turns into the much bigger sonata forms that we think of in the 19th century. Very elaborate procedures, very elaborate structures in which we have melodies, secondary themes, modulations, and so on. It keeps our interest. The narrative, the structure, the form, how we get from one moment to the next is very, very sophisticated in spite of the kind of surface simplicity we might hear. See how we have these contrasting melodies as we move from one moment to the next, almost like characters coming on to a stage during an opera. Another thing about this period is that there's a much more dynamic variety, that is to say, contrasts between louds and softs. In the Baroque era before this, the piece would tend to start in one level and maybe some contrasts here and there, abrupt contrasts, but in this period we have the beginnings of crescendos, much more flexibility of dynamics, and of course this is the time when the piano was invented, and so that's another reflection of this interest in dynamic contrasts. So the music of Mozart, the music of Haydn, the early works of Beethoven have a kind of poise and a kind of balance that leads us to call this period the classical era.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff at the keyboard, understanding classical music. Our cultural journey continues now from the concert hall to the opera stage in high definition with someone who knows his stuff inside and out. We're off to the Met, the Metropolitan Opera that is, to hear the world's best singers and arguably the best orchestra in the world as well. And get this, it'll be all from the comfort of the Triad. Thanks to Piedmont Opera, the entire Met Live HD performance series returns to Hanesbrands Theater in Winston-Salem. And for just $18, you can see and hear the Met live on the big screen in cinematic high-def splendor. The cost is $15 for students, and this year, on the cusp of Giuseppe Verdi's 200th birthday, the season includes performances of Otello, Un ballo di maschera, A Masked Ball, Aida, and Rigoletto. The next showing is Saturday, December 1st, with Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito, and you'll find links to the complete Met HD schedule at wfdd.org/triadarts. Piedmont Opera Artistic Director Jamie Albritton is here to pull back the curtain on Met Opera HD 2012-13. And the beauty of the Met, again, as you alluded to earlier, Jamie, they get to jump from the best of recent works in 20th century. I know they've done works by John Adams and others, back to Mozart. And
yes.
One of his last opera.
Next to last. Mm-hmm. Clemenza di Tito is an opera seria. He kind of abandoned opera seria. But after writing the big trilogy, Così fan tutte was the last of those three. Then he returned to seria for Clemenza di Tito. And then came Magic Flute, Zauberflöte, and that was the last opera. They're very lucky to have Elina Garancia is the mezzo-soprano who's singing Sextus. Mm-hmm. And the most famous aria from Clemenza di Tito is an aria mezzos all know, Parto Parto. It has a obbligato clarinet part, actually.
How
a very famous
that?
Obbligato clarinet mm-hmm. part. And wow, to have Elina Garancia, I'm looking forward to that one as well. Fans of HD will remember her from Carmen several seasons ago, and she was a fantastic Carmen. So perhaps, unfortunately for some, she was, you know, the sexiest Carmen on the planet, and now she has to turn around and do a pants roll, but we digress.
That's another story. It's HD 2.
Right.
Right. And again, on the 200th anniversary of the birth, a nod to the great Verdi and a new production of Un ballo di Maschera. Hey, what makes this guy so great? Verdi, I mean, besides the big grand chorus, from your opera perspective, what makes this guy so great?
Verdi is, he can capture an emotional moment on stage like I just don't know who. I mean, there are two people when I go to heaven that I want to sit and have long conversations with. One is Mozart and the other is Verdi. Oh, and okay. When Verdi first started composing opera, there were a lot of constraints put upon him by theater managers, impresarios, because there were expectations, very rigid expectations in the composing of an opera. You must give the soprano this aria in this position. You must have the chorus do a narrative chorus in this position. And Verdi grew up with those constraints and managed to turn them into something that you no longer recognized as formulae. And not only that, but he had the courage to break out of that for compelling dramatic reasons. And it is that you can't touch it sense of drama that he brings to music that is unmatched, really, in my opinion, almost to all of Italian opera. I know the Puccini lovers out there will curse my name right now, but but with the exception of maybe some moments in Tosca, to my mind, the power that Verdi can bring and the way that he can pace a drama is almost unmatched in 19th century Italian opera.
I got to say, as a freshman in college, I went to see La Traviata. I want to say Chicago Lyric, and was a naysayer and weeping at the yeah. last scene. And it just it hits you so powerfully, and it just snuck up on me. I mean, just wait a minute,
right.
I could not control it. That's a master of something.
Yeah, you know, Traviata to me, it's not just a great opera; it's the watershed moment in Verdi's career because he starts taking chances with Rigoletto. He takes more chances with even the selection of plot with Trovatore, and then with Traviata. Traviata cuts so close to the bone of his own life and the experiences that he was going through with the woman he was seeing after his first wife died, and he poured it all into that opera. After that, there was no turning back. I really think he began to figure out, no, that's opera, and that's where I'm going for the rest of my compositional career, and he does.
And more Verdi coming up in a huge production, big set, big choruses,
yes.
And nobody does it better than Verdi and Aida. And you get the benefit of the Met's largesse
yeah.
in the
You moment. Know, that's the thing. It's moments like this when it's really fun to watch the HD because I've seen this production of Aida at the Met. And it's huge. It's tremendous. It's so impressive. And the elevators going, you know, the stage elevators going up and down, and things are happening, and it's amazing. But then to be able to sit down and focus in on it and see all of the detail in that incredibly humongous set, that's really fun.
They've reconstructed the pyramids, essentially.
Pretty much. It's like downtown Egypt on the stage at the Met, you know? It's amazing.
Downtown Cairo. Right there. I can imagine it in HD on that big screen, sharing it with people in the audience.
Yeah.
It's got to be tremendous.
And that's the one that's around December. So just when your mind is starting to relax, you know, from all of your worldly stress as the Christmas vacation is coming, perfect thing to go is just sit there and let all of that grandeur roll over top of you.
That's Piedmont Opera Artistic Director Jamie Albritton. Thanks to Piedmont Opera and Haynes Brands Theater, the Met Opera HD 2012-13 season is alive and well and living right here in the Triad, 209 Spruce Street North in Winston-Salem, to be exact. For just $18, $15 for students, you can see and hear the world's most accomplished opera singers joined by arguably today's finest orchestra, and it's just a stone's throw away. If that's not enough, you'll see set and costume designs that'll have your jaw scraping the ground. Pretty awesome stuff. The next showing is Saturday, December 1st, with Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito, and you'll find links to the complete Met HD schedule at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and next up, it's Danu. A Christmas in Ireland is Wednesday, November 28th at 7:30 in Waite Chapel on the Wake Forest University campus in Winston-Salem. It's part of the same Seacrest artist series that brought you the Wayne Shorter Quartet back in September, and you'll find links to the complete performance calendar on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Danu, the traditional Irish ensemble, brings you all of the energy and beauty of the Emerald Isle. The five-member authentic Irish music ensemble features the flute, tin whistle, fiddle, button accordion, and bouzouki, and it's highlighted by local Irish Celtic dancing. Danu's fusion of the classic Irish culture and contemporary influences has thrilled standing-room-only audiences in Europe, North America, and the Middle East, and their popular recordings are available on the Shanaki label. You can hear their live performances frequently on this station as well as the CBC and BBC. Danu manager and accordion player Benny McCarthy recently spoke with me by phone from his home in Ireland.
I grew up and I basically listened to every accordion player I possibly could. Learned tunes from the ones I liked. After all of that, you kind of mix up different tune types, style types, to kind of concoct your own style, you know?
How did you learn the early goings here?
The accordion is quite new to Irish music. Like, the first recordings that we have of Irish music was by a German-Irish guy in New York. His name is John Jake Himmel. Some of the earliest recordings we have of him would be pre-1900 again. The first kind of known accordion-type instrument to be used in Irish music would have really been, like, late 1800s, early 1900s. And it's been, like, really adapted into that tradition, even though it's quite a new.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me as new when you listen to it, because it seems so perfectly fitting. But did you pick it up initially from someone in your family or friends? How did you learn to play
it? Well, we had an accordion at home, and I was fascinated. It was kind of in one of those cupboards, you know, in the house. And when I used to get my hands in it as a young kid, I was kind of fascinated with the whole idea of it. I was a late starter in music. I started when I was 13 years of age. That would have been late enough. Like, there was lots of kids playing since they were 6 or 7, you know. There was a great influx of music lessons there in Ireland during the 1980s and 90s.
Was that at school, or was there a teacher in town? Or?
Well, it was just various teachers setting up music lessons in parish halls. And the COLTIS is a big tradition Irish music organisation here in Ireland, and they would have aided, like, a lot of these classes, encouraging and getting different musicians to get teaching, you know?
I got a good friend who's a cellist who once told me he thanked his mom for giving him this musical language. I was wondering if you could describe the, you know, this tradition of passing down music and the songs from generation to the next. You know, what's it mean to you?
You know, I can remember being a kid listening to my great-grandmother telling me stories about the 1910 in Ireland, you know?
Yeah.
Music is quite similar, like, if you're kind of learning an instrument and you're a kid, it's the same as anything. If you want to drive a car, if you want to ride a bike, you're there as a kid, you're trying to figure it out. So you're soaking up everything, and when somebody shows you a little trick or shows you how to pedal a bike, it's the very same thing in lots of respects. And then it's down to yourself how you take that on board and progress, you know? If you have a rhythm, like, some people find it more difficult than others because, you know, people are more musical than others.
Sure.
but it's just down to the individual then how they progress. You know, I think listening actually is nearly more important than playing. You know, I see lots of kids even nowadays, they're amazing technically, like, but you can sense that they're probably not listening enough, you know, kind of saying that even to the young lads now. And, you know, they're taking it on board, and it's a very important thing, which I always realise that there's something to be gained, even from a musician that might be old, but mightn't be very good technically. He definitely has something to offer, you know, in his character, or be it in his certain interpretation of a tune, you know.
Yeah. I'm wondering where traditional Irish music is today in Ireland. I mean, traditional jazz in the States seems to be a dying art. What's the tradition like today in Ireland?
It's never been better. It's going to be interesting. I think in the next couple of years, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, like the kids nowadays have learned a very different way than I have. And, you know, I'm only talking, you know, I'm not even 40 years of age. I'm talking about kids that are 20 years my junior. In my lifetime, we were allowed to go into pubs when we were younger, even as kids, just playing music, you know?
Yeah.
Since, like, mid-90s, late-90s, they changed it. It became very strict, as in you had to be over 18 to be in a bar, and you can't be in there after 9 p.m.
Mm. That's when things are just warming up.
And that's exactly, that's my point, you know? That's when the old guys, you're not going to see the old guys in the pub before 9 p.m. They're just coming in. So there's been a big change in that area. You know what I mean? It's not all about the pub neither, but it was the pub for us growing up was the place where we were hearing these guys, you know? They liked going to the pub and maybe having a beer or two and playing their music socially like that, you know?
And you get to rub elbows with a different generation in that context. Without that, when are young people going to know?
You know, I grew up in, like I said, I was a young kid, 13. It was like guys of 20 in that session, there was guys of 90 in the session, you know?
Yeah.
Even in my whole area, even at this stage, like, I can talk about lots of people which I met as a kid, they're dead now, like. But I did actually get to hear them and be in the same room and feel it, like, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the standard of playing in Ireland is superb. It's, like, in accordion playing, like, there's young kids playing accordion now, they definitely have a higher standard than young kids were when I was learning, you know?
Yeah, the ball moves forward. I mean, it does. There's no turning
so
back.
So kind of, yeah, it moves forward, you know? So.
Yeah, what a beautiful thing to see. I'm wondering if you could describe for listeners, Benny, what it's like just carrying on this tradition up on stage in front of an audience.
You probably know tons of musicians that are scared lifeless of going on the stage.
Yeah.
It's the same here. I know some wonderful players that would never go in front of a crowd and say that they'd be too nervous. We as a group, all individually, got a great buzz from that. We enjoyed that. I think all of us kind of grew up doing kind of gigs and doing performances. So, you know, we took that on board as part of our upbringing as well. And we all enjoyed it. You know, nowadays we're doing it professionally. We never set out to do it professionally, you know. Like, I went to the college, like, to be an engineer, like. I never thought that I would be a professional musician. And the whole band, I suppose, you know, we started in 95. I think it was nearly 2000 before we actually said to ourselves, my God, why don't we be a professional band even though we were, you know? We were just having a good time and enjoying sharing it with people, you know? Yeah, and again, we enjoy the challenge of, like, you know, we've played in various different countries and, you know, the reactions, they kind of differ. We strive to get a similar reaction if we can, you know.
How about some examples?
Well, I suppose playing in Europe would be very different to the United States.
How so?
The Americans are very easy to let go, you know, and get into it. They're on your side from the get-go, like. In Europe, they're on your side, but they don't express it as quick. I have a feeling they may treat a performance very similar to a classical performance, you know.
Ah.
No, that's my kind of take on it, and that, you know, it might be disrespectful to clap along with the music. But I think, look, you know, sometimes we have to teach them how to do it. By the end of the show, they know everything about it, you know.
They're up and dancing.
They're up and dancing then, you know. But sure, look, that's the fun of it.
what can we expect here in for your concert in Winston-Salem? Share it for listeners.
Yeah. Well, again, we have a lovely program now. This is our Christmas in Ireland program. It's great fun, and then all of it, we incorporate some kind of carols. We have a few for the audience, like, sing with us. We have some Irish versions of tunes, talk a little bit about some of the traditions that happen in Ireland around the Christmas time, you know? I think a lot of audience participation will be expected on the night too, so we'll have a good time in it. You know, there's some beautiful songs there. We're doing a couple of lovely numbers there. Ireland is fantastic for Christmas because, like, it's like a 2-week holiday here or something. There's great music and all the musicians are at home and all that kind of stuff. So there's great sessions and great parties around the country at that time of the year. It's a great time altogether, you know.
That's Danu manager and accordion player Benny McCarthy. The music of Danu provides their audiences with an authentic Irish experience you won't soon forget. Danu's won the BBC Award twice and the Irish Music Magazine Award. They use traditional instruments, flute, tin whistle, fiddle, button accordion, and bouzouki, while mixing ancient Irish music with contemporary works to create music that's just out of this world. Their concert, A Christmas in Ireland, is Wednesday, November 28th at 7:30 in Wake Chapel on the Wake Forest University campus. It's part of the Seacrest Artist Series, just in time for the holidays. And coming up just in time for St. Patrick's Day, Dana will be back this spring at the High Point Theater, and you'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. Our producer and engineer is Eddie Garcia. Assistant producer is Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Natalie Barron. You'll find podcasts and links to more information about all of the artists featured today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.